News Talk Sunday.
Let's see what the papers are saying this Sunday morning. I'll run you through the front pages. We'll begin with the Business Post. Flight risk. This is an interview with Willie Walsh, who's warning that Aer Lingus is a target now in the US. And he's basically saying Aer Lingus is at serious risk of having its access to the US curtailed unless the government once and for all removes the passenger cap at Dublin Airport. The Irish Mail on Sunday has an interview with the daughters of a man detained in the US. And they allege that he has abandoned them and called for their father to be sent home to face justice on charges he was due to be up in court over. The Sunday Independent on the front page says that renters are going to be offered thousands of euro by landlords to leave their homes early as new reforms come into effect next month. Basically, the landlords are going to give them thousands, apparently, to get them out of the house or the property to try and start a new lease with new tenants. Sunday Independent also warning on the front page, passengers are facing a summer of chaos due to a growing air traffic control staffing crisis. This is the warning from the Irish Air Traffic Controllers Association. And the Sunday Independent tells us on the front page they have an interview with Mrs. Meskell, who is the mother of Paul, opening up about her famous family. And then on the Sunday Times, they are saying that the victims of the Krisla service station explosion have received no financial compensation for the pain and suffering they endured 3 years on from that tragedy. Of course, one of the worst tragedies in the history of the state. Also, the Sunday Times says Gardaí are raising concerns about policing the upcoming football match between Ireland and Israel, which will happen in the middle of the presidency of the EU. So there's going to be a lot of security demands. And there's a world exclusive in the Sunday Times. They have an interview with Harry Styles. If you're interested in that, we are told he's off duty in Italy, in his own words, Harry Styles, as he's never seen before. I did read the interview, and basically he likes sitting in cafes in Rome, drinking coffee and eating. And who doesn't, I'm sure. And that's the big exclusive that they have with Harry Styles. Now, let's introduce our panel this morning. Padraig Tobin, leader of AIM2, John Isle, deputy business editor at the Sunday Times Ireland, and Flora McCarthy, journalist and broadcaster. Good morning to you all.
Morning, Shane.
Are you all loved up after yesterday?
In need of coffee.
In need of coffee, yes, absolutely. Right, let's get stuck into the papers then. The first one, because it's interesting, Flora, it's in a number of the papers, a warning to Irish people in America going to St. Patrick's Day parades, which is quite interesting. And essentially, they're saying that there's a fear that ICE agents could go to the Paddy's Day parades and start cracking down on Irish people there who may be the undocumented Irish.
Yeah, you were speaking of fear of ICE in another context a few moments ago with snow, but yeah. I would question whether this is a massive fear, you know, linking all of this with St. Patrick's Day. There is a piece in the Sunday Times, as you mentioned, and they quote a lawyer, James B. Kavanaugh, from Omaha, Nebraska, who says there was considerable fear last year in the US on the Mexican holiday Cinco de Mayo that Mexican people would be rounded up. And so, I mean, if you're basing the fear on that alone, I don't know how much credence it has. However, there is genuine concern and fear amongst the estimated between 30 and 40,000, we reckoned, Irish illegal immigrants in the States whose status there is under question. And, you know, if they are more visible around events such as St. Patrick's Day, then yes, there could be.
I see this Kavanaugh lawyer, attorney and county commissioner, John, he also did an interview with the Irish Mail on Sunday as well. He's clearly very worried about this.
Yeah, and I think what that worry betrays is a sort of a knowledge or like the open secret or the tacitly tolerated Irish immigration over the decades where, you know, Irish have overstayed J1s or Irish have overstayed tourist visas and sort of fly under the radar because they either have a sort of a support network already built in the United States in cities like Boston and New York, and they're also sort of well-liked by the native population, right? They don't sort of stand out the same way Central American immigrants might, or immigrants, you know, from other countries with fewer material advantages. But I think the way ICE is behaving, and we've seen this, especially in Minneapolis over recent weeks, is behaving in a sort of indiscriminate way and sweeping up lots of people, and inevitably more Irish will be involved in these detentions. And I think there was a record number of Irish deported in 2025, 107, which sounds like a small number in the context of the overall ICE operations, but it's actually an 80% increase over the year before. So we see the direction of travel here. So really anybody who isn't properly documented in the United States who is an immigrant, and that now includes Irish people, is in a very vulnerable situation. And I think where it becomes an issue, irrespective of how you got there or why, is the appalling detention conditions that people are being held in, because so many people are being swept up in these raids. There aren't really the facilities to deal with them. We know that ICE has received a multi-billion dollar infusion of cash to buy warehouses all over the United States to house many of these detainees. But they're not yet online, and the places that they're being sent are overcrowded, understaffed, don't have proper medical facilities, are mixing all kinds of people together of different legal status, and worryingly, many aren't being able aren't being permitted to speak to legal representation. Yeah. That's against the Constitution in the United States. So it's a very lawless domain where these people wind up.
Potter, rather depressingly, the Irish might be okay because typically they might have white skin, though.
Yeah, I was over in Washington, D.C. and New York there about 3 weeks ago, and I met with Irish-American organisations there. There was a concern there, but it wasn't a massive concern in the discussions I had with them in relation to it. There are 12 Irish people, I understand, in ICE detention centres.
I thought the Taoiseach said it's 5 or 6. Is there now, has that increased?
The report in the papers there is today is saying that there's 12 there currently.
And it's difficult to find out what those exact numbers are because nobody knows.
Yeah, and like, that is a small percentage of the 40,000 odd people who are probably there illegally from Ireland. I just the front page of the Daily Mail is very interesting because obviously Seamus Cullerton has been in the news all week in relation to the fact, I think he's there 4 months at this stage in ICE detention in very poor conditions. But, you know, it's interesting to see that it looks like he actually had a drugs charge brought against him a number of years ago, which he didn't attend the court case for that. Yeah.
And in fairness, many, many years ago.
Many, many years ago, no, for sure, there's no doubt. And, you know, at this stage, if he was in Ireland, that would probably be in his own past at this stage. But he was also offered a flight back to Ireland instead of actually attending or being put into ICE accommodation over there as well. So many of these particular stories have particular twists in them as well and individual context to them too. I do think that we have to get to a situation though whereby these 40,000 individuals have their situation regularised over in the States at some stage, because 20 years over in the country, any country, and still being irregular is actually a very difficult situation.
We don't seem to have the support on the Hill that we used to have in Washington. I did two of the Taoiseach's visits to the White House, and it was all you could talk about was the undocumented Irish. It doesn't feel like we talk about that much anymore. And I'm just wondering, when you famously go up to Capitol Hill, do we have the support of the big American politicians now?
Yeah, so definitely, listen, since the Biden administration is finished, that's stopped. But I do think that the Irish-American vote is still a lever. Like, there is no French-American vote. There's no British-American vote. You know, even Trump himself is very aware that there is an Irish-American vote as well. So I imagine that, you know, there's always going to be, you know, a difference in how Ireland is treated in terms of the rest of the
story. Can I just say that none of us should really be surprised that ICE is making moves against the Irish as well. I mean, it was a MAGA drumbeat right from the start, get people out. ICE are apparently, as John mentioned, there's going to be a lot of work done on the detention centres. $38.3 billion, the US papers are quoting this week, that they're going to spend by the end of this year on the detention centres to detain and process tens of thousands. And, I mean, I don't think a bit of Irish blarney around St. Patrick's Day is going to change that.
Yeah. So the question now then would be, John, is the American dream over for people like from Ireland to go there with all of this that you could be facing? Is the kind of notion of the American dream dead?
Yeah, I think that's really beginning to dawn on people now. And as an American immigrant to Ireland, like, it's a sad development. You know, I begin to feel estranged from the country of my birth in the process of watching that happen. I mean, you can see it with people's reaction to the World Cup this summer, for instance, you know, where there's a real reluctance to travel, to spend all the money on hotels and stuff, and then have to, you know, deal with Customs and Border Patrol at the airport and the kind of interrogation you'll get where you have to surrender your phone. What type of data do you have to give up? Mm. You know, what type of intrusive questioning, all of that kind of thing. And then the risk, of course, of being caught up in a sweep on a public highway. You know, these things are actually happening in the United States, and it's not the sort of America that Irish people are used to visiting. It's changed a lot.
Paddy, you were there recently.
Yeah, I will say America has always been strict. Like, even in my J1 years in college, I remember, you know, fellow students going over to the States, landing in New York and then getting flown home straight away because they didn't have their papers in order. When I was a Sinn Féin TD, I had four S's on my boarding pass, which was the highest security level, which meant you had to go through 3 hours of interrogation at every airport there. And that was under the Obama administration. So, and these
when you went recently now, were you grilled?
No, actually.
Not at all.
It was, everything was very smooth. It was very polite and decent at pre-clearance in Dublin, and there was no bother at any stage over there. But I do think that America has always been strict. And it's interesting that these laws are not changed. It's the enforcement that's changing in relation to this.
And I think it's interesting too, Dan Mulhall, former Irish ambassador to the US, pointed out a few days ago that one half, he reckons, 50% of Irish Americans voted for Trump. And Trump and his administration were clear about what they were going to do about migration.
That's a good point. Like, when I was in the States, the attitudes towards Trump amongst Irish Americans is very different than the attitude here in Ireland.
I thought that you just don't mention his name in those communities, but they do openly speak about him.
I would say easily, as Flora has stated, that half of the Irish Americans I met there were very pro-Trump and actually very critical of Irish immigration law, even in Ireland. So there is, you know, there's two perspectives you know, those people are not seeing each other's perspectives in this debate.
And often very critical of the Irish media coverage of Trump.
Yes. Exactly.
Okay, before we move on, John, you obviously have the opposite experience, an American immigrant coming to Ireland. If someone was to say to you, I'm thinking of moving to America, what would you say to them?
I'd say you'd want to have a very good reason. I mean, look, the type of choice that an Irish person would make nowadays to go to the States is very different from what it would have been 30 years ago or before that, right? It's not really, it's a different kind of economic choice. You might be pursuing a marginally better opportunity than you would have been, say, fleeing unemployment in the 1980s, right? So it's a different type of calculus. And I think most Irish people who'd be going over have the resources then to back out of that if they have to. Like, having gone the other way, Potter makes an interesting point about, like, the laws have always been strict. The enforcement has changed. I'd also point out that the laws in Europe are not easier than the laws in the United States regarding immigration. Like, having gone through the process myself of becoming an Irish citizen, like, it wasn't an easy road. It wasn't nice. You know, I didn't feel particularly welcome or anything like that. And, you know, and you have to follow all the rules. And if you don't, you can't stay, right? So, like, you know, the point of this conversation isn't to say there should be no rules or they shouldn't be enforced, but, like, the particular manner in which the Trump administration is going about this, I think, is offensive to good democratic practice. And I think that is really what the objection is.
Okay, well, we hope you feel welcome now.
Of course, it's not a personal issue. Okay. It's a legal issue.
Right, I'll come back to some of your messages. I'd love to hear from you on that issue, though, of American ICE agents. You can WhatsApp 087 1400 106. If we're not talking Trump, we're talking housing. And this is the front of the Sunday Independent today, that the landlords look like they're going to be offering their tenants a lot of money to move out before these new rules kick in. Flora, do you want to just run us through that story? Because it's quite an interesting one. The panic is on before March 1st, it would seem.
Yeah, so a piece by Wayne O'Connor on the front of the Sunday Independent, Sindo, saying that renters could be offered thousands of euro by landlords to leave their homes early as the new reforms come into effect next month. So the new rules will mean that renters who sign agreements after that date, March the 1st, will be entitled to six-year tenancies. And so small landlords would also be banned from putting their properties up for sale without the tenants being left in situ. So some property agents are saying that this could devalue properties by as much as
30%. Just to be clear,
percent.
The idea of offering your tenants thousands before March 1st is to leave.
Yeah.
And then what do they do with the property?
The property can then be sold if the person wants to, but there's not much talk yet about where those tenants are supposed to go, because in the middle of a housing crisis, this is another leg to that problem.
John, from an economic point of view, you can understand why landlords might consider this.
Yeah, but I mean, it is no surprise that landlords are looking for ways to wriggle out from these new regulations, since they'll be costly in one form or another to implement. But they're also... It's also no surprise that they're trying to exploit tenants on the way out as well, right? So I would say, looking at this in a completely rational economic way, yes, I see why landlords want to get tenants out so they have an unencumbered property, either to get a new tenant in or to sell it. I'd be a bit skeptical of what estate agents are saying about the discount that landlords are having to will have to face if they sell their property. I'll believe that when I see it. But what I will say to renters is, like, do your sums properly. I think unless you're getting first month's rent, last month's rent, and whatever the difference is between your rent and the current market rent for the next year, it's not worth doing, because it's going to be so hard to find a place and you'll be paying so much more than you were already. That unless you're getting a big whack of money, like we're talking over 10,000, I don't think it's worth considering.
Interesting you mentioned 10 grand, Patter. That's one of the examples given in this piece. So if you're paid... If you as the landlord give a tenant 10 grand to get out of the lease, then you could sell the property vacant, no restrictions, full market value of 300 grand, and then maybe you'll get 40,000 euro extra. You can't blame the landlords for considering it.
Yeah, no, it's a cynical move to a certain extent, because remember that the purpose of housing obviously is to make sure that we have homes for families. And you know, the problem is when the property becomes a commodity rather than a home for a family, well, then you have these cynical type actions being taken. If you look at the law as a overall, the government have introduced this law to actually increase rents over time. And in their own admission, they need to increase rents, to increase investment within a sector, to provide for more construction and more provision of homes.
The government would say they brought in this measure to try and help renters.
The government has also said that it's expected the changes will attract private investment back into the market.
Yeah, so that's the key point. So there is benefits here in terms of, obviously, there's a fixity of tenure for 6 years, which is a positive. And we all know that from our history in terms of landlordism in this country, exactly. But the key effort of this is, as Flora says, is to create an investment opportunity for individuals coming into the country. Now, in my view, what they could have done in many ways is that they could have reduced VAT. They've already reduced VAT in terms of apartment building, which we actually support. There should be a reduction of VAT in terms of house building as well at this moment in time, like there is in the north of Ireland. It doesn't make sense in a housing desert that we still have enormous taxes on the provision of houses in this country. But the key point in the housing crisis is the same as in the flooding infrastructure. It's the same in the national hospital infrastructure, is that we have the slowest planning, permitting, licensing, tendering and judicial reviews system in this country. The process of actually getting to a building stage in this country is phenomenally slow, phenomenally bureaucratic and full of red tape, that the whole of the infrastructural process is grinding to a halt in Ireland. And that's the key element here.
I heard Gina London on News Talk Saturday last week saying, when she lived in, I think it was Colorado, that it's 54 days to get through the planning process. Right. Why is it, John, so slow here to do anything?
Well, I mean,
that's why you left.
The nice way of saying it is there's a surplus of democracy, right? Everybody does get a say. So we recently, in my own street, there's a large property on the corner that was granted or applied for planning permission to build two sort of outbuildings as well. And I know a neighbor was trying to sort of whip up a bit of activity on the road. In the end, it went through anyway. But the fact that, you know, everybody on the street gets a say as to what happens on someone else's private property, it like necessarily is going to take a lot of time to hear everybody and achieve community consensus. I think there's a very positive side to Irish society, and that is very pro-social. It's very consensus-driven. People care about their communities. But the downside of that is, like, you have to listen to what everybody says, and you have to take it all seriously and give them their day and et cetera, right? So, like, that does take a long time.
Do they care about their community, or is it not in my backyard?
I know there's both. There's both. I mean, I think, look, the lines get blurred there. I'm being as positive as I can about a practice I don't particularly like. I will say, on the other hand, that the sort of bureaucratic machinery grinds very slowly because politicians but pardon me, Potter, are terrified of making decisions, right? And what the Irish government has done with this law is they've created something, you know, to make it actually the investment market more attractive to large corporate landlords, right? Which will create a more efficient housing market. But there's a downside to that, right? You're losing that sort of personal touch. You're losing the smaller landlords, like those bits, those kind of infill landlords who you know, et cetera.
Doesn't the government say, John, that this is just one part of an overall plan?
Yeah, but like, I mean, we've heard that before, right? Like,
but we do enjoy plans in Ireland as well.
Yeah.
Laura, are there potential banana skins then with this idea that the landlords could start offering the tenants cash? Can you see that this
I
could become an issue?
See a few banana skins. One would be expectation of tenants. I mean, there's an example here given on the front of the Sindo by chief executive of DNG.
Yeah.
And he says, so if you own, he gives a concrete example, concrete. If you own a one bed apartment in the IFSC and if it's vacant, it's worth €300,000. However, if it was only worth €250,000 as an investment sale, it would make sense for you as the owner to offer a good chunk of the difference to the tenants. Okay. So there may be people who are expecting that. And another banana skin, sorry, is there's a bunch, would be, you know, we're not hearing from Focus Ireland or the Simon Community or other housing agencies.
Will the opposition jump on this now?
Yeah, there's no doubt that the government's, you know, plan has incentivized the in-situ tenants from being removed from homes, which is the absolutely opposite of what the government states that they're interested in. And we know that one of the biggest feeds towards the homelessness crisis at the moment, remember the 17,000 individuals now who are in hotels and hubs at the moment because of homelessness, is this the fact that people either can't make their rent payment or they're being removed from their homes in these fashions. And I think that's a heartbreaking outcome of this government's plan. And, you know, while the government's plan may increase market investment into the future, there's other levers that they could have done which wouldn't have hurt the tenant in the long run, which actually would have protected the tenant and still stimulated investment in the market.
News Talk Sunday. This is News Talk.
And you're welcome back to News Talk Sunday with me, Shane Beattie, with you until 12. I did say Eoin O'Brien will be with us after 12. He'll be with us after 11, just to be clear, because we're finished at 12, so he'll be here just after 11. Loads of messages coming in about ICE agents and about the undocumented Irish. A lot of people taking me to task using the phrase undocumented Irish. They think I should be saying illegal Irish. Why do Irish people think it's okay for them to be illegal in the USA? Of course they should be kicked out. Someone else says it's not undocumented Irish, it's illegal Irish. Another texter says, if Irish people are in the US illegally, then they need to be deported. This isn't racism, it is the law. So not much sympathy there for Mr. Culleton or indeed for other undocumented Irish who people want me to call illegal Irish. You can WhatsApp 087 1400 106 if you'd like to get in touch with us. Our panel to go through the papers is the AIM2 leader, Padraig Tobin, John Oyle, Deputy Business Editor at the Sunday Times Ireland, and the journalist and broadcaster, Flor McCarthy. Padder, there's a story in the Mail on Sunday today that if Gerry Hutch were to be elected, he's certainly getting the media coverage, which would help get elected. But anyway, if he were to be elected, it would cost the state absolutely millions for security for him. Now, you know how Leinster House works. Not the tightest place for security right now.
Yeah, so first of all, I do think that the media frenzy around Hutch is wrong, for a start. So I do think every single time there's a headline or a front page about Hutch, they're jacking up his votes. They're going to make a political celebrity out of the individual, which will just draw in the anti-establishment vote in terms of Dublin Central. You know, imagine, I see media scrums around Hutch, especially at the Dublin Count Centre there at the last election. Imagine if he had a media scrum around a politician because of the hard work that they did in their community in terms of that. So, you know, there's a real danger that the media approach is going to be a self-fulfilling prophecy in terms of Hutch's vote in this. In terms of the security...
I mean, he could also argue that Irish politics is so dull and boring that that's why the media are jumping on Hutch for something exciting to talk about.
Well, like to be honest, like I remember when Mick Wallace was in the Dáil, you could actually develop a really good bill in Leinster House, or you could wear a fancy shirt and have a big mad head of hair on you. The second process will get you more attention from the media, and the dull, boring, hard work in terms of housing or healthcare won't get you the media attention. And that's wrong, because otherwise, if we go down that route, we're going to incentivize celebrity politicians who are only noteworthy for the fact that they are you know, celebrities in their own right.
Right. Let's pretend he gets elected anyway. The Mail is saying that it would cost the state millions. And you work in Leinster House every day. I was saying security not that tight. Security sources are saying that were this to happen, there would be major investment needed to beef up security.
Yeah, so the Dáil, it has been wonderful in many ways in that it has been so accessible to citizens in this country. Schools, groups come in on a daily basis and they wander around Leinster House. They get a sense of the history. They get to see the politics working.
Unlike in a lot of other countries.
So if you go into Westminster, for example, you have to go through very heavy security. Mm. In terms of Capitol Hill in the States, it's incredibly, rough and hard to get into there. And I do think it would significantly reduce citizens' access to the heart of politics in this country, and that'll be a bad thing.
But Flor, what are we saying here about a character like Gerry Hutch? Is would he need security guards in his office? Would he have to be escorted by Gardaí every day? I'm not clear what the article means by this millions being spent.
I think probably security, as Pather is saying, is a question that is being looked at anyway in Leinster House.
Yeah.
And with... I think we're going to be talking later perhaps about the Irish presidency of the Council of the EU. Security is very much to the fore in that as well. And so in that context, perhaps they're saying that, somebody like Gerard Hutch becoming elected with a past that he does have is another added security issue. Here's the thing, though. I think like other candidates, unlike other candidates, Hutch didn't really make himself available for scrutiny the last time he ran for election, which was the first time. I was there in the Count Centre in the RDS on the day.
I was too.
Do you remember it was like the Dead Sea parting. There was Hutch with the entourage, the cameras flashing, and that was the big moment.
I also remember that he went to an area of the Count Centre where he wasn't actually up for election, and he was viewing the votes being counted in the constituency he wasn't running in too.
He was,
there
but
was
I
such
think
a scrum at the time.
While we mention media and Hutch, if journalists treat him as they do other candidates, if they ask him the questions with scrutiny about what is he going to do for his constituency, where did he get his money from, are his tax affairs in order, and all of that, then I think it would be a fair playing field.
They did try during the week at a staging of a play about Gerry Hutch's life, and I suppose others would say, do we need a play
and
about...
And he said, I'm not going to answer it, I'll just shut up.
Okay, let's move on, because the weather means we all want a holiday, John Isle, obviously, but if we are going to be going on our holliers, if you're to read the front of the Sunday Independent, we could have travel chaos this summer because there's a staffing issue with air traffic controllers.
Yeah, well, it seems to be a shortage of air traffic controllers such that they're having to work beyond their contracted overtime allocation, which is, I think, one day a month working in overtime. So you're having people, air traffic controllers being called in or being asked to come in and work on their days off, which isn't great if you understand what an air traffic controller is supposed to do. Like being able to have your rest and recuperation, et cetera, is very important for a job where lives are at stake and you need a lot of focus and attention. So obviously there is a staffing shortage. Wouldn't be the only industry with a staffing shortage, but it's a critical piece of infrastructure. We were talking before about the infrastructural challenges.
And they are well paid.
Oh, of course they are, yeah.
But there's still a staffing issue. It's very interesting that we did a scenario at Cork Airport during the week where one air traffic controller phones in sick, one person, and it results in the airport having to shut operations.
I think you're seeing this throughout the economy. It's not just in areas like this, but literally every business in the country. We're operating at basically full employment, right? So everybody is right at the edge of their cost efficiency and right at the edge of employment, right? So this is one reason we have such a high level of work from
it. Something such as landing planes or getting, helping them into land. And I really don't know much about this at all. But how could it be allowed to get to this situation where somebody calls in sick and you can't land planes?
We're in an international recruitment market for many, many staff at the moment.
Well, Dubai take a lot of
air traffic
controllers.
Exactly. But it interests me, though, like when the governments talk about $100,000 extra for the CEO for Ishka Aaron, they say, well, we have to pay more because we're in an international recruitment market. But when it comes to the 7,000 nurses who are now registered and working in Australia, that international recruitment market is no longer an excuse for their salaries anymore. Okay. So
we have a guest waiting patiently to talk about this, because I want to go to Paul Hackett of Click and Go and Vice President of the Irish Travel Agents Association. Morning, Paul. You've heard what our guests have been saying this morning here. Will estate agents, sorry, not estate agents, they're always of concern. Will travel agents be worried about this summer and people's holidays being affected?
Good morning, Shane. I think, yes, it is a real concern looking at the summer. And just to kind of put some pointers around this, the summer schedule for aircraft start when the clocks go forward. So that's the very end of March. So there isn't a whole lot of time to move this. Airlines work on a winter schedule, summer schedule only. And I said summer, 29 March, that's when it starts. But Padraig Tobin made a good point there. There is a global shortage. This is not unique to Ireland. Air traffic control is a critical skill set. Retention of those air traffic controllers is a real problem. And there does, from an outside point of view, appear to be some areas that seem to be within the remit and the control of the government in this regard, with regard to retention, addressing some pension and other IOR issues. So I think, you know, we can't control the global shortage that exists for air traffic control and the fact that this is a critical skill, but we can do the controllables. And after having resolved the cap situation, that's really important. Also, we have to recognise that this is regional airports, because the airports we're calling out are, you know, Shannon and Cork, as well as some impact in Dublin.
So potentially then for this summer, you could have the air traffic control shortages in, let's say, Dublin Airport. But then if I'm going on my holidays to France or Spain, I could have an air traffic control problem over there as well.
Well, look, you know, we're really trying to address what's happening in Ireland today. So globally, there is a shortage, and individual countries are addressing that by paying more and putting more incentives on the table to address that. So airlines and the Air Nav Ireland and other air navigation entities across the world are going to be looking to try and resolve this. Nobody wants this sort of an issue. Hopefully it gets resolved in terms of what we can control, but it is a challenge. There is a skill shortage here. There is retention issues here in terms of the skill set, and air passenger numbers are increasing. And we want to maintain that regional focus in this country in terms of growing capacity out of Cork and Shannon being very important and being in line with government policy. So I think what Minister O'Brien needs to do here is look at the fact that, yes, I understand from his point of view, he's probably saying there's impact on other public sector employees, as Padder also alluded to. But, here we have critical skill shortage. Aviation is critical to this country, not only from a holidays and a travel point of view, but also from foreign direct investment and inward tourism. So it has to be resolved.
Are flight cancellations inevitable this summer?
I don't think so. No, I think this is controllable and this is fixable, and that's what's going to have to happen. The Irish Air Traffic Controllers Association have been clear, FORSA have been clear, and Air Nav Ireland are clear. And you know, they have time. They have a couple of weeks in which to sit down and resolve this, and they really have to do so, because what we can't have is consumers and people who are looking to fly into Ireland to spend euros and dollars in Ireland right through the summer. We can't have the hotel industry impacted, we can't have foreign direct investment impacted, and we can't have consumers who are looking to travel for visiting friends and relatives, as well as holidays and leisure reasons, impacted.
Did you say summer begins in March?
Well, there's two schedules. There's only summer season and winter season in the airline world, and that moves when the clock moves. So summer starts when the clocks go forward on the 29th of March and ends when clocks go back at the end of October.
It'd be nice to have a bit.
That's when capacity. Yeah. That's when capacity increases, Shane. Okay. That's winter time we're managing at the moment, because winter schedules are always lighter. There's less capacity in the winter. But summertime, more routes open up, more capacity opens up, more flights from other destinations flying into Ireland also open.
Okay, but it'd be nice to maybe have a spring first, because we're not seeing much spring. But anyway, Paul, thank you very much. Paul Hackett of Click and Go, Vice President of the Irish Travel Agents Association. But John, how much do you pay them then? Like, I understand some air traffic controllers get like 80,000 a year. So how do we know enough how much we should spend to make sure we don't have a staffing shortage here?
Well, I mean, we call it critical infrastructure for a reason. I mean, this reluctance to pay for things we so clearly need is really self-defeating, right? So like, the price will have to rise until the positions are filled. Like, that's how a labor market works, right? Yeah. And if we want, and, you know, if as Patter says, foreign direct investment, if tourism is as important to the Irish economy as software engineers are, well, then maybe we should pay them as much as software engineers.
Just briefly, Patter, staying with aviation, because it's the main story in the Business Post. Willie Walsh is being interviewed saying Aer Lingus is at serious risk of having its access to the US curtailed unless we get rid of the passenger cap ASAP. I know there are moves on that. Is this something Micheál Martin should be raising with Donald Trump?
Well, I don't think Willie Walsh is probably a completely, you know, independent analyst in relation to this. Obviously, it's in his interest to get rid of the passenger cap. I look at the passenger cap, to be honest, in terms of spatial development. We are developing into a city state in this country. It's incredibly lopsided. There are people getting flights today who are travelling from Cork, from Galway, and Belfast into Dublin. And, you know, it is incredible that we're not making better use of our regional airports in terms of this. It's obviously in the airline's interest to keep their businesses compact in one location. But in everybody else's interest, it's better to actually have a better distribution spatially of these types of investments. So, you know, like obviously we have to be aware of what the Yanks are going to do because we're so dependent upon them. But we also need to make sure we spatially deliver properly here.
Okay. Also, poor Micheál Martin, there's a growing list of things that people want him to raise with Trump, who isn't going to listen anyway.
That could only be a very brief meeting. You might not get to raise all those issues.
News Talk Sunday. This is News Talk.
And you're welcome back to News Talk Sunday with me, Shane Beattie. Our panel are still here poring over the Sunday papers. Patter Tobin, John Isle and Flora McCarthy here. John, there's a lot of talk about the Ireland-Israel game in the papers today. The Sunday Times, though, is looking at actually the security concerns over the game. The guards are worried.
Yeah, the guards are worried because obviously there's a lot of there's a lot of political opposition to Israel, you know, playing within UEFA to begin with, but also coming to Ireland in particular, right? Nobody needs reminding that Ireland and the Irish people were among the vanguard in the opposition to Israel's military campaign in Gaza and like the continued military campaign in Gaza, which probably at some low level will be continuing when those matches take place. So the likelihood of protests is very high, first of all.
And a reminder, you can't even bring a flag in, a Palestinian flag.
Yeah, so there's a lot of those issues. And then, of course, there'll be traveling fans, right? And we've seen from Champions League and UEFA League, Europa League matches that there has been some trouble. I think particularly in Amsterdam, there was a Israeli club team was over there playing a Dutch club team and there was trouble between the fans. So like that's the kind of headache the guards don't want anyway. But this will be happening while the EU presidency is going on. So Garda resources will be stretched enormously to deal with the security concerns of the presidency, visiting politicians and various bureaucrats. On top of that, to host thousands of foreign fans of a country that isn't very well liked in this country, I think would be very difficult.
And a country that still remembers 1972 and Munich.
Is this a perfect storm for the guards, do you think, Flora? The fact it's happening in the middle of the EU presidency?
Yeah, it is. I'm thinking back to May 2011 when you had Obama visit and Queen Elizabeth II within a week. But this is, you know, the volume way up on that again because of the trouble that could happen.
Patter, there's talk in the papers too that the home game might be moved out of Ireland.
Yeah, I think it's a very, very difficult one because we know that, like, obviously 73,000 Palestinians were killed in the recent bombings on Gaza. 2,000 Israelis were killed by Hamas. Hamas is still on, still hasn't stood down or still hasn't moved about. So a lot of people will have significant misgivings in relation to this.
What's your own view? Should the game be going ahead?
Well, I will say this, on behalf of my party, we haven't met to make a decision on this as yet. Personally speaking, I'm very uncomfortable about the game going ahead. I just think, at all. Well, I just think that you know, in terms of Russia is not participating in terms of the Winter Olympics. You know, the IRFU when they went on tour to South Africa in the middle of the apartheid regime. You know, a lot of people say you shouldn't bring politics into sport. And I agree with that in many cases. But at times you can pull levers that do increase international influence over countries to get better results for people who are suffering. So,
and there is precedent. There are so many examples in history of politics and sport intertwined.
Yeah.
And as Patter is saying, Israel is a rogue state. Just look at the figures from the genocide. Is there not the same argument
you'd go with the Eurovision as well? Is there not an argument that you should separate politics from sport and music and things like that?
I think it's about
scale. Okay. Mm. John, what's your view on this?
Yeah, I don't think it's possible really to separate the politics. Like, that's a fantasy. Politics are in everything. They're in sport, they're in entertainment, etc. I think the issue here is that certain European countries are members of UEFA. Ireland, Spain, for instance, Italy, we were talking about earlier, are opposed to the Israeli team traveling. But UEFA isn't united on this. There are a lot of UEFA constituent countries who are fine with Israel's continued participation in the federation and with them playing in the Nations League. So Ireland and the FAI has a decision to make whether they're going to stick with the decision of UEFA to continue to include Israel as a member or not. And I think the consequences for Ireland, the football team and the FAI would be quite dire if they went against the UEFA decision to continue allowing Israel to participate. Okay. And so that's another aspect.
It's a rock and a hard place.
Yeah, just in terms of the security for the whole summer, I do think Ireland is exceptionally exposed in terms of the European presidency on this. So we know that our army levels are down probably to a record low. There's been some increase in the last year on figures. You know, we can float one Navy boat at the moment out of nine because of the lack of proper staffing within that system. You know, radar systems that were meant to be put in place are still not going to be there for another couple of years. The drones protection system are still not going to be there for a couple of years. I think the army have stated that they can only protect Baldonnel in relation to drones.
We may get help from the French.
And the RAF may help in relation to this.
We had Niall O'Connor from the Journal on yesterday, who's in Munich at the security conference. And he says when you walk down the streets of Munich that he's encountering police forces from other countries as well, giving them a dig out. So that can happen.
Yeah, but like, and there's a big debate happening here as well. And Helen McEntee stated this at the Munich conference yesterday. She says, we need to have a conversation about our security. And I was just having pictures of Helen McEntee walking down Dublin saying that Dublin is safe, you know, talking about the security of Dublin just before. And, you know, this argument is the government who has overseen the collapse of our own security is now pushing this country into further military ties with the European Union, talking about, you know, getting rid of the triple lock, talking about the necessity for being involved in you know, pan-European drone protections, investment in military hardware, etc. And it's so frustrating to see a government not actually investing properly in our military protection ourselves, and yet making an argument that we should actually dilute our neutrality and sovereignty even further in terms of EU military hardware.
I know it's certainly going to be an interesting summer. That's if people even realise that Ireland has the EU presidency. I'm not sure it's the first thing.
And is it the presidency of the EU or the Council of the EU?
I'm not sure people are lying in bed this morning going, I can't wait for Ireland hosting the EU presidency. But anyway, I know you are, but you're not normal.
Micheál Martin is as well, because he's gets to stay as Taoiseach for longer. Otherwise, he'd be out in his ear.
Let's stay with presidency of a different kind, because President Catherine Connolly has marked her first 100 days in office. Flora, you have that great book on Irish presidents of the past as well. What marks Catherine Connolly's legacy first 100 days? I was saying yesterday, we know she's good at sport. We know she can do some slam dunks basketball-wise. But apart from that, some people would feel she's been a little bit quiet.
But actually, on the slam dunks and the keepy uppies, which she had to do when
and
she
it looks
went
like
to the north.
Any sport she can do.
Yeah, but is she going to have to keep up the keepy uppies? Because in a way, it reminds me of, is this going to follow her around like Pope John Paul II, who once kissed the tarmac at Dublin Airport in 1979 and then had to do it wherever he landed? But 100 days.
First 100 days.
Well, it's a good excuse and a reason to look back and see, you know, how she has been doing. And it was expected that she would keep her head down. She sort of has, in a way, in that there hasn't been a huge amount of public engagement. She fulfilled her promise, obviously, to visit Northern Ireland, where most of the presidents go for their first visit, and often the second one is to our neighbours in Britain. But, I mean, the president's diary is very full. It's published by the Oris. It's there on the website. She has been back over to the west of Ireland a lot, 80 engagements. Listed earlier this week, a quarter of the engagements so far were in Galway. Surprise, surprise. Others were in Dublin, 30 of them, divided between Ors na Uachtaráin and various places in the capital. She's been to Sligo 5 times, to Kerry, Clare, Monaghan, Meath. So the visits are going ahead, and there is one she's due to go to London in the coming months. And so, I mean, it's not as if she hasn't been busy.
Okay, so it's kind of a wait and see on that. Would you say the Gregory Campbell incident is probably the most high profile that she's had in those 100 days?
Without a doubt, yeah. And the one that she would be hoping will not be remembered.
Had her very briefly, yeah.
Yeah, I think she was very dignified and respectful in that regards. And Gregory was like strategically provoking her, you know, and disrespecting her to just rile up his own particular base. You know, like his attitude was so asymmetrical. Not only would he never say Derry, but he wanted to control the president's language in terms of Derry and Londonderry as well. But in actual fact, the solution to this is that we live in a pluralist country and we shouldn't have to wear each other's political clothes. You can be a unionist and say Londonderry, and you can be a nationalist and say Derry, and we should just respect that.
Okay. John, we've saved the biggest story to last because I see in the Mail that Brooklyn Beckham has unfollowed Gordon Ramsay after Gordon Ramsay told him, remember where you came from. It's amazing grown men are behaving like this.
I don't know
how
I got stuck with this one. I don't know. I mean, it's very depressing to watch a family unravel in public like this. I don't know why Gordon Ramsay felt compelled to say something in public also. Apparently, he's a friend of the Beckhams, his son.
Apparently, he's David's best friend, which
yeah,
I didn't know.
Good friend of David. I mean, you know, Gordon Ramsay has a soccer background. I think he was played with Rangers.
And David cooks a lot, like apparently.
And Brooklyn, I think, is trying to make his way as a chef now. So look, there's a bit of crossover. The Suns, I think, are friends.
But the big news is that he's unfollowed Gordon on Instagram.
Yes, I know. Look, I'd say from Gordon Ramsay's point of view, not knowing the man at all, he's looking at this saying, oh my God, what if this happened to me, right? I think that's a terror a lot of people have when they watch this sort of family estrangement take place, is that it's going to happen to them and they feel compelled to register an opinion on it.
And in public.
And in public. It is public. Better off staying out of it, I think.
Brand Beckham under threat. Listen, thank you to all three of you. Really appreciate it. Pat O'Toole, John Isle and Form McCarthy. Really appreciate you spending your Sunday morning with us.
News Talk Sunday.